America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, the wildfires are slowly diminishing, but there's still a serious problem in Southern California, raising a lot of questions about who was doing what, when, and how, and why, with regard to preventing them. Here you have the governor and the lieutenant governor, two completely different messages about whether the National Guard being in Iraq had anything to do with the inability of the state to quickly put these things out and stop them. So we'll get into that and many other things. We've got some interesting economic news on the horizon. As we go on through our hour, also in our second hour, here in the state of Oregon, we've got a school that's fingerprinting kids in order to get them into the cafeteria. Is this another step down the road to a police state? And Congressman Earl Blumenauer is going to be calling in about the Iraq spending legislation. In our third hour, Hustler magazine editor and author of Progressive Hollywood, Ed Rampell, is going to be with us talking about the blacklist. This is the anniversary of the Hollywood 10, and we'll be learning all about that. First, though, one of the ongoing issues, this is continually, basically since the election of Reagan, obviously long before that, but, you know, during the New Deal era from 1932 until 1981, basically from the 30s until the end of the 70s, there was a broad consensus in America that government could do, you know, useful things and positive things and play a role and all that kind of thing. And then Reagan came along and changed the meme.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And ever since then, there's been this steady war on government being involved in the commons, in us protecting us. And food safety is one of these issues that's at the front. And Greg Conko is with us. He's the director of food safety policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
My question, Greg, is how can, I know you guys are in favor of the food industry being basically its own cop. How can we trust companies with the safety of our food supply when legally, by law, by Supreme Court decision and also by, you know, the way the charters are written in the United States, state charters, their first priority is profits for their shareholders rather than the safety of their product?
Well, I think the important question is to ask whether a company is likely to profit by poisoning its customers. And the answer, of course, in almost every case is no. We at CEI, we're not opposed to government involvement. We think that the government can play a positive role by setting broad standards, performance standards, for the food industry and for other industries. But it's important, I think, to recognize that you know, with close to a billion meals eaten in the United States every day, it's really impossible to expect that federal regulators could inspect more than, you know, a tiny fraction of the food we eat with any practical positive effect. So ultimately, we have to rely on market forces. Now, that combined with things like the threat of civil penalties for common mishaps.
Market forces are fine, but the CDC says that 76 million illnesses, 325,000 hospitalizations, 5,000 deaths in the United States every year is a consequence of foodborne illness. And we have what you're suggesting is essentially what George Bush did with the oil industry in Texas, where he took mandatory regulations that had serious civil penalties associated with them, made them voluntary, and within 4 years, Texas became the most heavily polluted state in the United States as a consequence of that.
I think you may be misinterpreting what I'm suggesting. Since the mid-1990s, we've actually seen a marked reduction. Unfortunately, we do have quite a lot of foodborne illness cases, which I think is always going to have, we're going to have to deal with as long as our food is grown outside and in and around dirt. You know, bacteria, other microorganisms are just part of nature, and although we can take steps to minimize our exposure to those things, no amount of regulation is going to make food perfectly safe.
Now, but the nastiest ones aren't from nature. The nastiest ones are from the overuse of antibiotics in factory farms.
There is
mutating.
That's not the case.
That's not where E. coli H157 came from?
If that were the case, no, actually, there's there's a substantial amount of evidence that that is not where E. coli 157 came from.
How did it acquire its antibiotic resistance?
Beginning with the Clinton administration in the early 1990s, the federal government installed a system called Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Points, or HACCP for short. The acronym is HACCP, in which food industry players were required to do a risk analysis of their process from beginning to end, identify the points where foodborne illnesses were likely to be introduced or expanded in the system, and to do testing on their own of each of these critical control points to ensure that that at each step of the process the food was becoming cleaner, not dirtier. Since that time, since the early 1990s, the incidence of foodborne illness has fallen, pretty substantially so.
But that's not market forces. That's the government saying we're going to kick your ass if you do this wrong.
In part, that's correct, and I think that. But those are the kind of sort of broad safety standards that that we would.
But you're arguing against that, aren't you? I mean, you're saying that industry should be regulating itself, not government.
What we're saying is that industry has a substantial interest in cleaning up its act. And also that to think that we'll totally rid the food supply of microorganisms is a pipe dream. Nevertheless, I think we're, you know, setting those kinds of performance standards for industry is perfectly appropriate. But ramping up inspection and on-site regulation of the kind. You know, in every slaughterhouse in the United States for meat or poultry, we've got a USDA inspector who looks at every single carcass that goes through the slaughterhouse and then is put on the market in the United States. This does absolutely nothing, because all they're doing is they're looking to see if, you know, maybe there's some fecal matter.
They also have the stereo detectors in those slaughterhouses by law as well. I mean, it's not just some guy standing there looking. The listeria detectors, and I think that there's detectors for other types of bacteria. I know, or maybe they're just generally looking for bacteria, but I know of one particular case involving listeria that was huge. These are mandated. These are required.
Those are part of the HACCP program that, depending
to the Reagan administration, actually.
Was first experimented with in the Reagan administration. It was fully implemented under Clinton. But ultimately, I think it's that kind of you know, using modern technology to actually test for the kinds of things that are really harmful.
Well, here's the question, Greg, because we're talking, by the way, with Greg Konko. He's the director of food safety policy at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Their website, CEI.org. If I own a company and I'm selling my product nationwide under 50 or 60 different brand names, and, you know, I can increase my profit by not letting people know that one of my brands has been contaminated, but rather simply just collapsing that company and coming up with a new brand, why not do that if that's the more profitable thing? I mean, there's frankly no shortage of instances of companies doing just that, going all the way back to 1909 when I think it was Sinclair Lewis wrote The Jungle about the meatpacking industry. Which led to the creation of our USDA and FDA.
Well, shuttering a company doesn't insulate the owner from legal liability. It certainly doesn't, neither civil liability nor criminal penalty.
But very often people can't track back the source. I mean, you know, there was a case during the Bush administration, the Bush Elder administration, where it took the CDC, they had to use DNA analysis to track back the source, and it was one of the largest meatpacking companies in the United States, and they were covering it up and continuing to ship this stuff, and they knew it.
You know,
they ended up paying a $200,000 fine and pleading guilty. They killed like 20 people.
Well, you know, this is a tragedy, and it's very unfortunate. But that's not to say that this is common practice in the food industry or any other industry for that.
Without government regulation, it may well be. It certainly with a large nation where you can operate anonymously, it makes it a fertile place for sociopaths.
I disagree. But the meatpacking industry is the area of the U.S. food supply that is most heavily regulated. You know, to suggest that that more regulation of the kind that we're likely to see is going to do anything really really practical is, you know, I think it's a mistake, and we have to rely on market forces.
Okay, Greg Conco. People can read about it over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute's website, CEI.org, the Director of Food Safety Policy. Mark, thanks for coming on and talking about it with us today.
Thanks again for the invitation.
You're welcome. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Oh, it was Upton Sinclair, not Sinclair Lewis, who wrote the Jungle. Thank you, Lauren. Lauren knows everything. Sort of like Mikey. No, that was Mikey Elite. Lauren knows. Sort of like Einstein. There you go. Our Lauren, our call screener, she is so good. From my book, Unequal Protection. I actually wrote a book about this. You know, what's the appropriate role of a corporation in America? The subtitle is The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. And it centers around the Supreme Court decision in 1886. But bringing it to today, in 1998, one of America's largest meatpacking companies replaced, and this really and truly was one of the three largest meatpacking companies in the United States. They replaced a refrigeration unit on one of their processing lines. They had detectors at the end of the line that look for cold-loving bacteria, specifically Listeria monocytogenes, I think it is. And a couple of days after they replaced the refrigeration unit, this bacteria detector started going nuts. So beep, 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 beep. You know, and the meters and whatnot. The company's response was immediate. As Carolyn Smith DeWall of the Center for Science and the Public Interest told reporters Russell Mulcaber and Robert Weissman, quote, their tests started coming up positive, so they stopped testing. They unplugged the machine. The company's Fourth Amendment right to privacy blocked surprise inspections by the government, so they didn't have to worry about that. The detectors were apparently turned off for a full month as people were dying around the United States from the bacteria that was dripping out of this new air conditioning unit. Finally, the Centers for Disease Control used DNA fingerprinting, to track the bacteria that was causing the national outbreak of Listeria back to this particular plant, which then led to a nationwide recall of about 1 million pounds of the product. But during that month, hundreds of people had been sickened by the Listeria, and 21 human beings had died as a consequence of eating the products of this one of the largest meatpacking companies in the United States. The U.S. Attorney's Office met with the lawyers for the meatpacking company, and they agreed that the company would pay a $200,000 fine, and they issued an unprecedented joint press release. This is the first time that the USDA, this was the George Bush Senior Administration, remember Dan Quayle and his Let's Make America Competitive initiative, which is basically let's deregulate everybody? Well, the USDA and this company issued a joint news release that managed to say that the company had paid the fine without ever mentioning the brand name of the product that had been contaminated and caused the death. Afterwards, so they got away with it. Afterwards, Mulcaber and Weissman raised the case with the White House with the press secretary, Ari Fleischer. This is an amazing little bit of dialogue. Russell Mulcaber, he says, Ari, has the president expressed a view on the death penalty for corporate criminals, that is, revoking the charter of a corporation that has been convicted of a crime that results in the death of humans? Ari Fleischer, the president does not weigh in on these matters of justice. They should be dictated by decisions made at the White House. Ari, no, wait, excuse me, question, Russell. No, Ari, wait a second, wait a second. He's in favor of the death penalty for individuals, generally. Is he in favor of the death penalty for corporations convicted of crimes that result in death? Ari Fleischer. These are questions that are handled by officials at the Justice Department, not by people at the White House. No death penalty for corporations. No siree, Bob. Let them kill off 21 Americans. In fact, some 5,000 people, actually, in the United States will die this year, in all probability, according to the Centers for Disease Control, from foodborne illnesses. Three pathogens, Salmonella, Listeria, and Toxoplasmosis, responsible for 1,500 deaths a year. This is pretty mind-boggling, you know? And we have an agency. We actually have two agencies in FDA and USDA who are supposed to be taking action on this, and to a large extent are, and do. But ever since the Reagan administration, there has been this steady drumbeat to reduce the power of these organizations and replace it with corporations self-policing. Let's leave it to market forces. Well, how can you leave it to market forces when the company succeeds in the product that killed 21 human beings, the name of that product never even making it into the news release? When there's that level of collusion between the company and the government, when there's that level of control over the media, when you have multi-billion dollar corporations buying so many advertisements for products that nobody ever wants to buy so that the news media will never investigate them. I mean, you got companies running ads for multi-billion dollar, $100 million, $500 million oil drilling rigs. You got companies running ads for $3 billion fighter planes. Do you really think that I'm going to pick up the phone and say, hey, I'd like to buy one of your fighter planes? No, this is about saying to CNN and the big networks, you're going to lose hundreds of millions of advertising dollars if you do any serious investigative reporting on our war profits, for example. I mean, this is all part of the same fabric. Just deregulate it all.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, but when we choose, using our freedom to choose, we'd like to know that the choices that we are choosing among, since all of us don't have the ability to, you know, carefully and safely monitor all food that's coming into our house, is safe. And that it's safe not because if the company poisons me, that the bad publicity will cause them not to poison you, but rather because the company has decided in advance that they're not going to poison either me or you, because the government is going to whack them upside the head big time, financially, legally, and maybe even put their executives in jail. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Casey in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Casey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. You're wonderful. I love listening to you every day.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just called because I had a question. So I don't understand the difference if a company is allowed to know that they're poisoning people. So, like, if somebody went to a bake sale, right? And they knew that, like, half their brownies were good and, like, half of them had, like, rat poison or something.
Yep.
That would be, like, a huge big deal. The person would obviously, like, go to jail. So, especially if corporations are the same as individuals.
Yep.
I don't understand the difference. Like, $200,000 fine.
The difference is that corporations, first of all, they're a separate entity. You can't put a corporation in prison. And which is why the only remedy, in my opinion, for this is the corporate death penalty. That is to dissolve the corporation, which is something that, frankly, before the 1880s was fairly common in the United States.
Right.
And number one. And number two, basically what we're talking about here is wealth and power. I mean, that's what it boils down to. You had the Bush senior administration.
The loss of human life, you know, people are not replaceable. Can't believe.
That's the point that was made by the unions in the 1930s. In fact, that was one of the things that led to the Wagner Act in 1935, the right to unionize, was that unions were one of the most effective bulwarks against corporations having unsafe workplaces where workers were considered expendable, where workers died on a regular basis. But you're absolutely right, Casey. It's horrific. It's a terrible thing, and it needs to be changed. It absolutely needs to be changed. And the first step, in my opinion, is undo corporate personhood. Well, actually, the first step is to change the minds of Americans, is to get out there and change the worldview. We've got to roll back Reagan's craziness, basically. Stephen in Montvale, New Jersey. Hey, Stephen. Stephen, you're on the air.
How are you, Tom?
Yeah.
Hi, my name is, as I said, Stephen. I'm off of New Jersey. I'm a trial attorney, personal injury, and I can tell you without question that there is not a trial attorney around that will accept a case involving food poisoning unless it results in death, which is a rare exception. The overwhelming cost and the difficulty in proving the liability makes it impossible to think that market forces and risk of liability is going to be enough of an incentive for a corporation to be its own watchguard with regard to unsafe products. We don't accept food poisoning cases unless it's some extreme level of damages, which is extremely rare.
Interesting. Stephen, thanks for that. It makes perfect sense. And in fact, I know that there was a study, we had the stats on it the last time we did a show on this, which was about a year ago, as I recall. There was a study which I don't have in front of me, that found that when restaurants knew that there was a regulator in the area, that the regulator was employed, et cetera, they had fewer rats and fewer cockroaches, whether or not the regulator showed up. When restaurants thought that the regulator had been laid off because of budget cuts, or in fact was laid off because of budget cuts, there were more roaches and there were more rats, and there was presumably therefore also things like, you know, more people getting food poisoning from the restaurant. Minor, you know, not major kill you food poisoning, minor diarrhea kind of food poisoning, that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's not uncommon. Good point, Stephen. Thank you very much. Virginia in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Virginia.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show. I am a working chef, and as a working chef, I must say it's impossible to have the market forces working in the way that these free marketers are talking, as you were saying earlier, without real knowledge of where your food is coming from. There's no real way to boycott Cargill. There's no way to...
You mean because it's ubiquitous?
Because
it comes at you in 100 different brand names?
Exactly, and they can just close down one, rename it, and it'll, I mean, where, especially if I walk into my local supermarket and I buy a package of ground meat, that's not labeled in any way, shape, or form. It's labeled by pound and weight. I have no idea how to boycott whatever's in that styrofoam container. I personally have taken a very extreme sort of stance on that. I'm personally a vegetarian, which I don't advocate for everyone. It's a personal choice. Food poisoning is on the lower end of the reasons. But what happens, but, you know, every 6 months, there's a massive E. coli spinach recall because meatpacking plants are dumping literally feces in their fields, contaminating every form of our food source.
Right.
It's weird that our
vegetables are contaminated by feces from animal agriculture, but that's the reality. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and that was my own personal boycott, and I'm still paying the price for an unregulated meatpacking plants doing whatever they want.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'd just like to say, finally, before I go, I do think that free market forces can work on a very small scale, which is, until, you know, we can get a larger political movement, put the teeth back in the FDA, as Chuck Schumer recently said, it's a toothless tiger right now. I think the best way to really know where your food is coming from is to shop locally, shop green market. You really meet your farmer. If someone gets sick, if something's under quality, you can go back and talk to them.
You're absolutely right, Virginia, and it's brilliant. It's well said. We have here in Portland there's two companies actually competing with each other that will bring organic food to your house every week. You know, a box of mixed vegetables to your house every week. It's so cool. And there's farmers markets all over the place, and this is happening all over the United States. And you're absolutely spot on. It's the best way to do it. Terry in Iowa. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Tom. How you doing? I have to say the gentleman that you had on earlier this morning, he said that it is not in the best interest of market forces to be poisoning their customers. And I have to say there's quite a few industries out there that would tend to disagree, such as
the tobacco
alcohol,
industry,
tobacco, medical, you know, how many pharmaceutical companies would have Vioxx still on the market if they weren't worrying about getting sued because of it. I mean, there's no way that a market...
Of course, the civil lawsuit, he would argue, is part of the market forces.
Kind of. I mean, you know, if even a civil lawsuit, it ends up, they pay out some silly amount of fees to lawyers, and just keep on doing business.
The problem, and this is what the woman who called, who was a chef, was saying, is that, you know, with Viagra, you know what it is. No, it wasn't Viagra. Vioxx. With Vioxx, you know what it is. You know where it came from. You know who the manufacturer is. It's, you know, it's patented. It's trademarked. It's a single name. It's a single product. It's easy to identify and therefore relatively easy to sue. If you've got a meatpacking plant someplace that's part of one of the big three meatpacking companies,
Iowa. We have one of the largest meatpacking plants here in the country. I mean, we've got three of the largest. We've got John Morrell here. We have Iowa Beef, which used to be Tyson until they got purchased by Iowa Beef. There's more meat coming out of Sioux City, Iowa than probably anywhere else in the country as far
as I know. Here in Portland, Oregon, for example, there's no, if I ate meat, which I don't, but if I went into a store looking for, you know, some hamburger and I wanted to know that it didn't come from one of your companies there because they had a bad track record, there's no way to know. There's no label. It simply says hamburger.
Well, and it wouldn't matter, you know, the reason why these meatpacking plants have, you know, such poor health conditions and things like that is because 90% of them are illegal immigrant workers that are working in the plants. I mean,
yeah, well, that raises a whole other issue, and that's not so much the illegal immigrant workers. It's a company that's willing to exploit human beings is also willing to produce a product that might kill human beings, in my opinion. But good point, Terry, good point. Dan in San Diego, California, listening on KLSD. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind?
Yeah, good morning. It's good to hear you on the radio again. Last few days, you know, they switched to emergency coverage, so I had to live stream whenever I could.
Yeah, well, good on them for doing that. I tip my hat to the folks at KLSD for doing live and local coverage and doing live and local programming for that matter, and you know, with Stacey Taylor and John Elliott and whatnot. And but the fires, we've been covering them on this show. A friend of mine, in fact, has a house up north of San Diego, and half his neighborhood burned out. It's where I stayed, where Louise and I stayed 3 weeks ago when we were in town there doing the show from KLSD studios.
Yeah,
and,
strike close to home.
Terrible, terrible time for you guys.
Yeah. Anyway, I just had a quick comment. What you said about Ari Fleischer in answering the question about food poisoning. And he said, like, well, you know, we don't get involved in that. That's an issue for the Department of Justice.
Right.
And, well, yeah, who was man in the Department of Justice? It was all Bush loyalists. And so guess which way they would rule on that?
Yeah, exactly. Good point. Good point. Absolutely. Thank you. Brian in Rochester, New York. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say in response to the guy you had earlier that there's no way to know what food or product caused your cancer or Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease to even, you know, boycott or sue, even if you could do that.
So you're talking about the problem of long-term exposures. You're absolutely right. Cancer, typically the time from exposure to appearance is 10 to 20 years. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob, I think it's pronounced, mad cow disease, 2, 3, 5, 10 years in some cases. Absolutely. Very, very well said, Brian. Thank you very much. Good point. Roland in Medford, Oregon. Hey, Roland.
Hello, Tom. Good morning. I just have a quick thing. If these people from the CEI and the corporations they represent are so confident that the market forces are going to cause them to do the right thing and not do the wrong thing, why would they be so afraid of having an overarching government agency sanctioning them if they don't?
Well, I'd say in large part because, well, assuming no malice on their part, which can, you know, on the part of at least these guys, because of their ideology. Because they have this belief, this religious belief, that if you simply turn everything over to multinational corporations, you don't need democracy. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-22.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour. Hey, tonight, or tomorrow night, rather, at 7:30, I'll be at Elliott Bay Bookstore in Seattle, Washington, signing books and saying hi. On the 27th, Saturday, I'll be down at Sonoma State University at receiving the first place Project Censored Award and giving a speech. On November 3rd, I'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, doing a book signing in Hastings Books and Music at 5 p.m. And I'll also be the keynote speaker at the Holistic Management International Conference on November 3rd. So a lot going on, and just absolutely nutty stuff going on out there in the right-wing world. It's just totally bizarre. Dana Perino asked about global warming, and, you know, obviously it's on everybody's mind right now with the wildfires. She says, well, I'm sure a lot of people would love to ridicule me when I say this, but it is true that many people die from cold-related deaths every year. There are studies that say that climate change in certain areas of the world would help those individuals. Well, yeah, maybe. But heat kills a lot of people, too. Hello, Dana! And Dick Cheney fell asleep on camera today. Yesterday, during a cabinet meeting. His spokesperson laughed it off, saying that he was meditating. I wonder if maybe he's converted to Islamofascism, and it's one of the five prayers a day that Muslims don't go there. No. Okay. All right. We won't do that. Amy Schmaus is with us. She is the owner of Wild Birds Unlimited in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Every week we want to highlight, just for a very short feature, one of the local advertisers on one of our local stations. And Amy, you've been advertising on KTRC in Santa Fe, a station that I've been on for many, many years. And tell us about Wild Birds Unlimited.
Hi, Tom. Actually, it's Ann, not Amy.
I'm sorry. Yes, okay. Ann.
We love Air America. Wild Birds Unlimited is a wild bird specialty store. We sell bird feeders and binoculars and books and bird seed and all sorts of things for people who want to attract backyard birds. And we've been there for 14 years, and we love it. I had the same kind of store in the Twin Cities where I lived for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been with Air America for probably 3 years, and it is by far our best advertising. And we've done other radio. We're currently doing National Public Radio in addition to Air America. We've done commercial radio. We've done newspapers. We've done TV. We've really covered it. And I just can't tell you. People would tell me, gee, this Air America phenomenon here in Santa Fe is huge. And it is. Customers come in, and not only does it bring a lot of new customers in, and we have about 30,000 customers a year that come to our store, which is about a third of the population of the city. And many, many of them are brought in by listening to your broadcast.
And well, that's great.
And it not only brings in new people, but the thing I love about it is why we're in business. We're a small business, locally owned. We really like to cement the loyalty that we have with our local customers. And they like to come in and tell us, you know, we're here because you advertise with Air America, and we want to let you know that we appreciate it. We have that comment, I think, a couple of times a day people tell us that.
That's amazing.
Really,
that's wonderful. We're talking with Ann Schmaus. She is the owner of Wild Birds Unlimited in Santa Fe, New Mexico. They advertise on KTRC in Santa Fe. And Ann, before I let you go, just one quick question.
Yeah.
How do you turn your backyard into a bird feeding habitat?
Well, a lot of it's habitat. Shrinking habitat due to lots of environmental things you know about are causing diminishing bird populations. So if we can create an oasis in our own backyard, whether it's putting out the right kind of bird baths, the right kind of food, but also planting a lot of native species so birds have an oasis.
Hmm. And so you can help, you advise your customers on that. And thanks so much for being with us.
Tom, it's great to be with you. I love your program.
Thank you. Great talking with you. Wild Birds Unlimited in Santa Fe. Check it out. Ann Schmaus. Felicia in Union City, New Jersey. Hey, Felicia, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I really enjoy your program every day. My comment is that part of the reason that the market forces won't work is because the food industry has such influence in USDA that the USDA policies actually thwart most attempts to try to trace back to the source of the problem. This year, so far, there have been at least 30 million pounds of ground beef recalled, and less than 150,000 pounds of that came from plants that could have been the source of the problem, from the slaughter plants. I've been working with some food safety whistleblowers since 1995, and it's really the regulations that are a big part of the problem. And they're
is this because of the revolving door?
Pardon me?
Is this because of the revolving door policy that people go to work for the FDA for a year or two so that they can then get $1 million-a-year job in industry?
Well, that's a big part of it, but it's not only the revolving door. I mean, in the meetings and behind the scenes, the food industry lobbyists are very very active.
We need to criminalize lobbying. I mean, individual citizens should be able to talk to their legislators and say, these are my concerns. But big enterprises, their CEO should be able to call up, I suppose, and say, hey, I'm a voter, I'm one voice, and should be able to say, okay, we've got 1,000 employees. Hey, you guys, all you employees out there, if you would like to call the legislator, that would be nice. And if the employees really believe that the employer is doing the right thing, then they could all call, and lobby as individuals. But my guess is that in most companies, you're not going to find that the employees are going to say, oh yeah, I'd be glad to do that. I mean, just this whole thing of hiring people by proxy and bribing legislators and calling it lobbying, it's so weird and so twisted and so sick. It's amazing. Felicia, thank you very much for the heads up on that. Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sheila, just a few seconds here before we've got to wrap this hour.
Okay, well, I'll make this quick. A while back, I heard a program of an interview of a Dutch chicken farmer. And he said that they have no need for antibiotics. They don't give the chickens any antibiotics because they sterilize the coops at least once every 2 weeks. And in the United States, they're sterilized like maybe once a year.
So they just practice cleanliness.
They
don't have a problem with antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Right.
Sheila, thank you for the heads up on that. That's a fascinating factoid. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up next is fingerprinting kids at school, another step on the road to the police state.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
So how does a police state come about? That was really interesting last night watching an interview, I believe it was on Keith Olbermann's Countdown, with Garry Kasparov, the chess champion, who is running against Vladimir Putin. And he said, you know, what's the state of Russia? And Kasparov said, well, it's a police state, period. How does a police state come about? For those of you who have read 1984, George Orwell's brilliant novel, which is no longer required reading in schools across the United States, but it was back in the 60s and in the 40s and the 50s and the 40s. Interestingly enough, was required reading in the 40s and 50s and 60s because conservatives were worried about a police state. And, you know, really lobbied hard to have George Orwell's 1984 in the curriculum of public schools, and it was. So here now in Oregon, we're seeing something played out. It's happening all across the country, but this is a local story for me. And may well be today, and if not today, next week, a local story for you as well. This from the Statesman Journal, which is a local paper here in Oregon. It's the Salem paper, the state capital. Article by Thelma Guerrero. With the federal government lagging behind on its plans to implement the use of electronic passports, ID cards, and driver's licenses, biometric vendors are targeting a new market. Schools. Now, that's an interesting frame to start this thing out with, first of all, that this is being driven by the free market. There are companies that have come up with fingerprint scanning machines. Yeah, we've got this little, it's just a, you know, an inch and a half wide, 2.5 inches long, just a little visual thing. You put your finger on it and it just goes beep, yep, instant recognition. This is called biometric data. That is to say, it's a metric, it's a measurement, and it has to do with your biology, specifically your fingerprint. It's being used at the state and middle school's cafeteria. The associate director of the ACLU in Portland, Oregon, said this is biometric data collecting. This is the big brother theory. The last thing we should do is teach parents and their young children to be casual about turning over personal data like a fingerprint just for the sake of speeding up a lunch line. And that's what they're doing it for, is the lunch line. Instead of kids showing a card showing that they paid for lunch, or instead of them paying for lunch as they go through, or passing in coupons or food stamps or whatever, however it may have been done in the past, or instead of the cafeteria person saying, oh yeah, I recognize you, you're here, you, Or for that matter, I mean, geez, back when I was in school, it was just lunch was free.
Of course, that was back in the old days when we had this was before the Reagan tax cut, you know, when you made over $3.5 million a year, you paid 91% income tax.
Anyway, now they've got to figure out who can and who can't have free lunch, who qualifies for lunch and who doesn't qualify for lunch, who are we going to charge, who are we not going to charge. And so what they're doing is they're basically teaching kids that their finger is like a credit card. Just put your finger on the little pad and we'll know right away whether you've paid or not, or we will charge you. Now, the superintendent of the North Santiam School District, maybe it's Santiam, Jack Adams, says this isn't the actual fingerprint. He says this is a string. Here's the actual quote. He says it's three mathematical pieces of information taken from a student's finger. It's stored on the school's computer and it can't be used in any other way. Well, technically, I guess that's right. You could say the same thing of any image stored on a computer. I can just see some guy who is busted for illegal pornography on his computer. That's not kiddie porn or something. That's not pornography. That's actually a string. Well, if you look at the file, you see it's a series of numbers. Yes, of course, it's a series of numbers. It's been digitized. It's been reduced enough. That's how computers store information. But it's your string. It's unique to you or your kid. Britta Hampshire of Staten, one of the parents, a little upset about this. She has a 10-year-old daughter. Her daughter came home from school on September 24th and said she'd been fingerprinted. Her mother's like, what? They say it's not a fingerprint, but it is, she says. I don't know that hackers won't be able to steal my daughter's fingerprints in the future. And again, the school folks saying, "All it's just a number. Don't worry, it's just a number." The middle school's new scanner plots points on a fingerprint and then converts those points into an encrypted number. Well, over in England, in the United Kingdom, this is actually picking up in the schools as well. And there's an entire website. A guy named David Clotter has created an entire website around this. It's called leavethemkidsalone.com. And David Clotter says, you know, talking about actually, this is Jonathan Adams. He's a parent in Hadley, Suffolk, whose son was fingerprinted a year ago because they're doing the same thing in the school there. He says, it turns out the school's been using biometric fingerprinting for 5 years. They never considered asking the parents' permission. He said, in theory, my son's fingerprints have been removed from the system, but these are ordinary computers. They're networked with other schools. They're linked to the local authority, and in turn, they're connected to the wider Internet. He says, I'm an IT professional. I know about IT. Any geek in a back room with cutting-edge software or hardware can get in to copy the biometric data of my child or any of them. So David Clouder is turning this into with his leavethemkidsalone.com website, into an issue of they are taking our most personal information, and now it could be hacked. It would be possible if you could hack into one of these school systems, and it may tomorrow be your employer, or the week after this, it may be the subway system. It may soon be your bank, whatever. They could hack in, and they could get the biometric data, and now they have your fingerprint. Nobody's ever going to question a fingerprint, right? And then we're going to see the Mission Impossible thing where, oh, yeah, here's a little piece of rubber that you can put over your finger with a phony fingerprint on it that you just walk up and you lay down on the biometric detector and it says, oh, yeah, you're Tom Hartman, aren't you? Is fingerprinting kids at schools another step down the road to a police state? Are we acclimating our children to the idea, well, you don't need no stinking liberties? I'm concerned that we are. I think this is a dangerous step. I think kids should be taught that their biometric data and all of their data is private. And that it only should be given out if somebody has a damn good reason to take it. Naomi Wolf has written a brilliant book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot, Citizen's Call to Action. And you just, you know, she's talking about, here's how you take down a democracy. Invoke an external and internal threat, establish secret prisons, develop a paramilitary force, like Blackwater, surveil ordinary citizens, like gathering their fingerprints, infiltrate citizens' groups, arbitrarily detain and release citizens. Yeah, create a little terror there. Target key individuals. Yes, let's go after Code Pink. The key individuals.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah. Restrict the press. If you can't restrict it, buy it. Cast criticism as espionage and dissent as treason and subvert the rule of law. And Naomi Wolf lays out how it's all done. And I would submit to you that these kinds of things cannot be done unless you have a citizenry that has been gradually and slowly acclimated to it. To the idea that, oh, we don't, you know, liberty, that's a quaint notion. Freedom, the Fourth Amendment, privacy. You know, our president is listening to our phone calls and reading our email, and that's just fine. Maybe he's looking at the Democrats, but we'll trust him not to be using it for political purposes. After all, only Richard Nixon ever did that. No modern Republican. Oh, well, and there was that guy 2 years ago working out of Orrin Hatch's office who hacked into Ted Kennedy's computer for a year and a half. Well, maybe some of the Republicans would do that, but not all. Are we heading down the road to a police state? If so, how and where do we stop it? Where do we start drawing the lines? When do we push back? How do we raise the alarm? 16 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
And now what if they are hearing just exactly what you say?
If they're listening to 900 calls, they ought to help you pay.
Soon they'll know your every fetish.
And they'll know Tom Cruise is gay.
I've wondered for so long.
They will know if on his birthday you don't call your Uncle Brent. They will know if you don't call that girl with whom the night you spent. Yes, the White House needs intelligence, but this ain't what we meant. They got the whole thing wrong.
No chance they're going to catch Osama, or as Rudy Giuliani refers to him, Obama. Rihanna Eisler, by the way, for our listeners in Portland, is going to be 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, speaking on her book, The Real Wealth of Nations, Creating and Carrying Economics. This will be tomorrow night, Friday night. So just a quick heads up for our friends listening in Portland, Oregon. Rudy Giuliani, I was tempted to do this as a crazy alert, but really I think it's a perfect segue from the topic that we've been talking about. Gradually getting acclimated to a police state. Rudy Giuliani was asked if waterboarding is torture, and he says, I'm not sure it is. It's like that's how far we've come. Waterboarding began during the Spanish Inquisition in the 1400s. It was used along with the rack. It was called toca, along with garrocha or strapado. And it consisted of introducing a mouth into the cloth of the victim and then spilling water over a jar so that they had the impression of drowning. In colonial times, agents of the Dutch East India Company used waterboarding. During the Amboina Massacre, 1623, at that time it consisted of wrapping a cloth around a victim's head, after which the torturers poured the water softly upon his head until the cloth was full up to the mouth and nostrils. During World War II, the Gestapo, the German secret police, used this technique as a method of torture. Come on, Rudy. If this isn't torture, then why don't we just say, okay, let's start using it in every police department in America. Let's just start waterboarding. It's not torture. It's not cruel and unusual punishment forbidden by the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. And if it's not, then, you know, as my producer David Poole said, let's, you know, think somebody's shoplifting at the Safeway. Let's get them in the produce aisle. Bring out the rack. Flip them head down and start pouring water down their face. I mean, this is serious stuff. Poorly executed, waterboarding causes extreme pain, damage to the lungs, and can cause brain damage from oxygen deprivation and sometimes broken bones because of the restraints applied to the struggling victim. The psychological effects last long after the waterboarding ends. The fear of being killed is a terrifying experience. We're talking about inducing post-traumatic stress disorder in people. Dr. Alan Keller, director of the Bellevue NYU program for survivors of torture, says he has treated a number of people who have been subjected to forms of near asphyxiation, including waterboarding. He said it is indeed torture. Some victims are still traumatized years later. One patient couldn't take showers and panicked when it rained. Waterboarding, this is Porter Goss, former director of the CIA, describes this as a professional interrogation technique. Journalist Julia Layton lays it out. Waterboarding, as it is currently described, involves strapping a person to an inclined board with his feet raised and his head lowered. The interrogators bind the person's arms and legs so he cannot move at all, and they cover his face. That's enough, frankly, in my opinion, to consider it torture right there. In some descriptions, the person is gagged and some sort of cloth covers his nose and mouth. In others, his face is wrapped in cellophane. The interrogator then repeatedly pours water onto the person's face. Depending on the exact setup, the water may or may not actually get into the person's mouth and nose, but the physical experience of being underneath a wave of water seems to be secondary to the psychological experience. The person's mind believes he is drowning, and his gag reflex kicks in as if he was choking on all the water falling on his face. CIA officers who subjected themselves to the technique last an average of 14 seconds before saying whatever the interrogator wants. This is the other problem. Not only is it immoral, not only is this another example of the road down to the police state, not only is it immoral, not only is it not the America that we have held up to the world for 200 and, well, until the modern-day Republicans came into power that we've held up to the world, but it's also not effective. When you torture people, they will tell you anything. Bush went through yesterday or the day before, he went through this list of, well, we stopped this attack, we stopped that attack, we stopped this other attack. How do you know? You tortured some guy and he says, yes, I'm gonna blow up the so-and-so building in Los Angeles. Yeah, how do you know? The bottom line is you don't. And in fact, what we do know is that a lot of the intelligence that was obtained by torture by this administration led us to do some really stupid things like invading Iraq. This is immoral, it's criminal, it's wrong, and Rudy Giuliani, for not denouncing it as torture, has revealed himself to be an absolute proto-fascist. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. And
welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for our blog and all things going on around those kinds of things. Ahmed in New York City. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you, Tom?
I am very well, but I'll get better. What's up?
You're from the state of Michigan, am I correct?
That's where I was born and grew up. Yeah,
I grew up in Michigan myself. The state's proud of you.
Well, thank you.
I was an assistant. I used to be an interrogator in the United States Marine Corps, and I I went to a full scale Marine Corps interrogation school. I was taught a foreign language. I was in northern Iraq in 91.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the Marine Corps deploys a unit, like a battalion-sized unit, they take their own lawyers. And we're very careful in how we treat prisoners, because if you make, if you go into torture, you are charged by the Marines for breaking the laws of land warfare and Geneva Convention.
Right. Well, I mean, this is one of the things that we charged people with in the Nuremberg trials was torture.
And also,
so is waterboarding torture, in your opinion, as,
of course
a, as a trained Marine interrogator?
Unreliable information. You get your information from prisoner, from ploys, mind games, to get him to override his sense of loyalty for his country and cooperate. Interrogation is an art, and it's a science. These people that are waterboarding, these are criminals. They're not bound to any kind of creed or a military tradition. These people are criminals.
Why do you think it is that the American people, or the people in general, are so quick to believe the storyline that we so often see in movies and TV shows, where if you just hit the guy hard enough, he'll tell you the truth?
Because that's what they're taught. They have no experience in interrogation. You know, get rough and they'll cooperate. That doesn't work in a real interrogation, you know.
Yeah. I think maybe it's because most of us as kids have had the experience of dad getting really angry and we say, okay, I'll tell you, you know, that kind of thing. But in an interrogation situation, it's not dad.
You know,
it's a whole different thing.
It's, when I first heard about waterboarding, it was something like you see the medieval times in a dungeon, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's where it started. It started in the Spanish Inquisition. It
doesn't have any place in a professional military unit. And that would never happen in the United States Marine Corps that I was a member of for over, you know, 8-9 years, you know. So that's where I come from, Tom. And thank you for your time and putting me on your show.
Thank you, Ahmed, for sharing your experience, your expertise with us. And
when was the last time you were
in Michigan? To our country. Last time I was in Michigan was a few months ago. I get back there a couple times a year because my mother still lives there and my three brothers and all their family and everything. So
we come from a blessed place, that's for sure.
Yeah, we do. A couple of Michiganders here.
Awesome.
Ahmed, thanks a lot for the call. Great,
thank you,
great to hear from you. And
bye
thanks
now
for listening to us on on WWRL there in New York City. 1-866-303-2270. Roxanne in Washington, D.C. Hey, Roxanne, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. What's up?
Good. I'm a big fan. I'm calling in regards to your earlier conversation about the children being fingerprinted.
Right. Is this the beginning of a path down the road to a police state?
I agree.
Is this all part of the whole same thing?
I totally agree, and I would not doubt if in addition to fingerprinting the children, in some kind of way they're getting their DNA. Because I really believe eventually they're going to try to start banking or whatever they want to call it, our DNA.
In the United Kingdom, there are more than 5 million people whose DNA is now held in DNA databanks, and many of them are school children. So,
right.
You know, odds are it will be coming soon to a school near you.
Well, you know, it's really frightening. I grew up in the late 60s, 70s. And before then, you know, I'm African-American, and I remember when, you know, my people in the South, they couldn't even vote. And so I know how important the Constitution is, how important our rights are, and I just really wish that Americans would wake up and see what they are doing to this country and to us.
Everybody, you know, the pitch that the right-wingers put on this thing is, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to fear, and if we have everybody's DNA, then we can instantly solve all crimes. But the larger issue is, what happens if the government becomes the thing that you need to fear? And then, and I realize this has traditionally been the territory of the John Birch Society and the conservatives and Barry Goldwater, the Republicans, but frankly, with George Bush in charge of the executive office, I am concerned about our federal government.
I am, too. I'm very afraid, and I, you know, with the common sense that's been intentionally taken out of our country and our thought processes and everything else that's going on, I'm really afraid.
Yeah, good point, Roxanne. Thank you very much for calling and making it. It's appreciated. Brian in Gladstone, Oregon. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Yeah, this is Brad.
Oh, Brad, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. I'm also a transplanted Michigander, so.
Wow, there's a bunch of us out there.
Yeah, I guess so. I was calling about the waterboarding.
Mm-hmm.
The film Rendition.
Yeah, Louise and I saw that last Saturday when it opened, or Friday, I guess, Friday afternoon when it opened, and it's an amazing, in addition to being an extraordinary movie about, you know, torture and waterboarding and everything, it's also just a great movie.
Yeah, I saw it. It really illustrates how the conflicts get started, and then they just kind of escalate from there.
Yeah, yeah.
Realistic portrayal, and when you see it firsthand like that, it's definitely in the category of torture to me.
Yeah, I agree. Brian, thank you very much. And in fact, when we first went, I was going, oh, you know, I really don't like going to movies where I feel miserable afterwards. You know, you walk out and you feel like you want to barf or something. And that was not what happened. It was very tastefully done, very artfully done, brilliantly done, frankly. It wasn't a horror film. And it was an extraordinary story. I mean, it was a story about people, about Egyptians, about people in the Middle East, about terrorists. You actually get inside the head of a suicide bomber, and about the CIA and people who think that waterboarding and extraordinary rendition and torture are just fine. And you get inside everybody's head, and the movie doesn't really draw a judgment. It just says, here it is. You figure it out for yourself. And it's also just a great drama. I mean, there's two major twists in the movie where you go, whoa, I didn't see that one coming. I just thought it was a marvelous movie. I really liked it. Stuart in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Hey, you know that banks have been doing this thing where they make you give your fingerprint, you know, when you cash a check, that you don't have a checking account?
Now, I remember that back from the 70s. We owned a business. Louise and I owned a business in Michigan. This was in 1971 or maybe 70 even, and a small TV repair shop. And, in fact, it was the only business that we've ever started that we didn't build up and sell off. We just, you know, it kind of killed itself. But in any case, at that time, there was this thing that came along where you could buy these little stickers that you, because we had a big problem with people passing bad checks. And everybody did back in that day. And there were these little stickers you could put on the back of a check, and you'd have a customer hit their thumb on a pad of ink and put it on the back of the check. And everybody was all upset about it, you know, oh, my God, I'm giving up my thumbprint. But the reality is that nobody ever looked at that thumbprint. There was no metric. There was no system for tracking them. It was only to intimidate people. The whole purpose of it was to cause somebody who is thinking about passing a bad check to say, well, do I really want my thumbprint on this bad check or my fingerprint? And the evidence at the time was it was fairly effective at that. You know, arguably, that's also a step down the road, and I have to admit that we actually used that when we were accepting checks, and it was a cheap way to avoid the damage.
It's ineffective for a bunch of reasons. It's easily overcome just by twisting your finger when you make the print.
Yeah.
And you know, people at banks are not at all vigilant about it.
Yeah.
You know, because they're the first line of defense. And I actually asked bank managers to give me their fingerprint.
Oh, that's interesting.
And usually what happens is that they just waive that part of it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they ask me what I'm going to do with it. I tell them, well, I'm going to put it in a safe place just like you told me you were going to do with mine.
Wow.
You know.
Well,
so usually they waive it. But I've had a couple of bank managers just go ahead and do it. It's no big deal.
What, you give know? You their fingerprint?
Yeah.
Whoa, Stuart, congratulations. you blow my mind. That's great. I
realized that my smudging mind was not helping anybody else and wasn't awakening the bank people to the, you know, severity of what they're asking.
Yeah, that's a great one. Stuart, thanks a lot for the call and that's a good one. Philip in Quilcene, Washington, am I pronouncing it? Yeah, hey, Philip. We've got about a minute before a break here. What's up?
Well, I would just like to hear, regarding the waterboarding and other forms of torture, either by the press or in questioning the new attorney general, I would like somebody to ask whether they would put their mother, their grandmother, or their daughter naked in a cell or waterboard them. I'd like somebody to ask one of these people that question.
I mean, this has always been our measurement. You know, you treat people the way you would want to be treated, even in time of war, for example. I mean, George Washington was the first U.S. president to say, give them no reason to complain for their treatment. And the consequence of that was that it shortened the Revolutionary War because droves, large numbers of British soldiers defected or not defected, surrendered to U.S. forces, knowing that they'd get three squares and a good night, you know, and a place to sleep. And many of them stayed and became some of our very best U.S. citizens. And it's, you know, the same thing in Germany. German soldiers were surrendering.
Do it to their mother.
Right. Would you do it to your mother? Yeah. Somebody ought to ask Giuliani that. You know, if you thought, or your brother, you know, if you thought that your brother was, you know, or your son. Yeah, man. It doesn't work. It makes us look awful in the face of the world. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Well, my face may not be pretty and my clothes are not the best. And there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track. I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars. And I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
Indeed. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with us, with you and with us now, former star of the Stephen Colbert Show, and the congressman representing Oregon's 3rd District, Earl Blumenauer. Hey, Congressman Blumenauer.
Thanks, Tom.
Maybe you don't want to be reminded of that little
bit. Oh, the guy who said my obsession with bikes borders on the interesting.
Yes, it was a good segment. Anyhow, you have taken a position with regard to George Bush's request for another $189 billion, which, by the way, is more than any year of the Vietnam War cost, inflated to today's dollars, in terms of today's dollars. You've taken a position that I am astounded more members of Congress haven't, and I'd like to ask you why not. But first, let me let you lay out your position.
Well, I just feel at this point it's past time. There is no justification for giving this administration a continued blank check on funding this war. And I have personally just resolved that I'm not going to vote for any budgets that are to continue the war. I'll fund protecting our troops and redeploying them and bringing them home. But stuff like this, I just think we've got to draw the line. You know, you're right about, Tom, we've been going on here longer than World War II. We've spent, what, five times more on the reconstruction, twice as much on the reconstruction as we did on Japan, which is five times larger. After World War II.
And it worked.
And we dropped a couple of atomic bombs on him. I mean, this is beyond the pale, and I'm just through.
Yeah, well, good on you. The Constitution, Article 1 of the Constitution, which, of course, defines the nature and role of Congress, says, this is Section 8, Paragraph 12, says that Congress shall raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. In other words, I mean, this goes back to that debate that the founders had. Jefferson thought that there shouldn't even be a standing army during time of peace. Adams thought that we should have a standing army all the time. And that debate in part led to the Second Amendment, but it also is clear, you know, it also led to this compromise that's in the Constitution that says there will, if Congress doesn't vote for it after 2 years, the military dissolves into nothing. And, you know, I mean, right across the board. And that's pretty strong language. How can the administration claim that they run the military, that they control the military, that they can, when the Constitution is so explicit that not only do you guys, not only does it originate with you, but you have to revisit it every 2 years?
You have led a number of discussions over the years. These guys don't get tripped up on little things like the Constitution. But it was clearly envisioned by the founders that Congress was to keep the executive on a short leash when it came to the war powers, that these were not exclusive to the commander-in-chief, that we declared war, and that it wasn't something that was open-ended. And once it happened, there was just, you know, you just went on autopilot for years, and that these people had their way for decades. And I think the best way to start now is pulling back on that leash and making clear that this is a finite level of authorization, and I want to come back and revisit the authorization itself, but in the meantime, I'm not voting for any more of these funding items.
Congressman Earl Blumenauer of Oregon's 3rd District, how many members of the House of Representatives, how many of your colleagues do you think share your sentiment, and how do we help others come into this?
Now, Tom, I think we are reaching a point where there are a lot of people who are just on edge here. The Republican base still thinks George Bush is great and they support the war. But more and more people here in Congress are having misgivings. I think the number of people who have just had it in terms of the funding, they're not going to proceed. We're actually right now in the midst of a vote clarifying the S-CHIP. And I will tell you that we're going to pick up more Republican votes, and I just think we're close here. I think it's critical that people call out what is happening with funding the war, call out what has not happened in terms of accountability. And I think the more direct pressure that members of Congress hear from people at home, I think it's going to be making a difference in the months ahead. I know there's a lot of unease. I think it's building, and now's the time to not let up.
Yeah. So to that end, we've put a website up, callcongress.org, www.callcongress.org. It just has all the toll-free numbers and the main number for the switchboard to call Congress. And call your member of Congress and let them know. Here's the question. Bush's popularity rating is 25%. Nixon's at its lowest was 24%. More Americans, more than 25% of Americans believe that Elvis may still be alive. More than 25% of Americans cannot accurately identify Europe on a world map. More than a third of Americans, 30% of Americans believe that aliens have contacted members of the U.S. government. I'm not talking about aliens from Mexico. When we're talking numbers that are clearly fringe numbers like this, how is it that the leadership of your party is still so timid and afraid of this president?
Well, first of all, let me be clear that the numbers that are there, there is a difference. Independents and Democrats are the ones who think that George Bush is just off the edge. The Republicans still agree. I think that, frankly, the leadership has not been as aggressive as it could be in some instances. I'm really glad that we're coming right back with S-CHIP. I think that the work that's been done by Henry Waxman in terms of spotlighting this stuff, but the practical matter is we don't yet have a progressive majority. We still have problems in the Senate, and
So the bottom line is we need to let our elected officials know that we've got their backs. We will support you. Don't be afraid anymore. Don't be timid. We're here with you.
And to push it right back at George Bush.
There you go. Push it right back. Congressman Earl Blumenauer, congratulations on a principled stand. Thank you for being
here.
Always
a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. This is the 60th anniversary of the Hollywood Fights Back radio program. It is the anniversary of The Blacklist, the Hollywood 10. Ed Rampell is with us. He has articles on The Blacklist over at Bob Shearer's TruthDig.com in the current issue of Writers Guild magazine. Written by magazine is the name of the article, the magazine. He's a movie critic. His reviews can be read at losangelesjournal.com. He's also the features editor at Hustler magazine and the author of a brilliant book, Progressive Hollywood, A People's Film History of the United States. Ed Rampell, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. I should also add your website that you participate or write over at the website, disinfo.com, disinfo.com.
That's right.
Ed, tell
it. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tom.
No, you were saying.
No, I was just going to say if people want to find out more about the Progressive Hollywood book, disinfo.com is the right website.
Okay, great. Ed, tell us about the I think everybody has a vague knowledge of the blacklist. Probably most of my listeners were not alive when the blacklist was really rolling, you know, strong, and or were not, you know, paying attention anyway. You know, we're too young to remember. And, you know, it's more of the time of our parents and grandparents. And very few people, I think, have ever heard of the Hollywood 10. Give us a snapshot of the blacklist in the Hollywood 10.
Basically, during the Depression, a lot of the screenwriters, in particular in Hollywood, were left-leaning activists, as well as actors and directors, but as primarily screenwriters. And before America entered World War II, they were kind of considered premature anti-fascists. Then, after Pearl Harbor, to make a long story short, suddenly they were in vogue, and they were the most politically savvy artists who were able to put into the words of the actors depicting our fighting men and women the anti-fascist ideas, what they were fighting for. And people like Dalton Trumbo wrote great anti-fascist World War II movies, such as 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, and John Howard Lawson wrote Sahara, an action in the North Atlantic, starring Humphrey Bogart, and Albert Maltz wrote Pride of the Marines, and so on. And they were in vogue. The Hollywood left had its Kodak moment, so to speak. And then once the Cold War started, yesterday's Soviet ally in the Great Crusade to end fascism, so to speak, suddenly they were no longer in vogue. The USSR was our Cold War enemy, and a chilly wind began to blow across Hollywood and America, and by 1947, the House Un-American Activities Committee was holding hearings first in Los Angeles and then in Washington, D.C., 60 years ago this month. And 19 of the witnesses that they called refused to cooperate and to play ball with this fascistic committee that included a lot of reactionaries, people like Richard Nixon, for example. Mm-hmm. And they ultimately called actually 10 witnesses who refused to answer yes or no the $64,000 question, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? And they stood on their First Amendment constitutional right to insist that the government could not compel people to reveal their political associations. And they were cited for contempt of Congress. They became known as the Hollywood 10, 8 screenwriters, 2 directors. And ultimately, they lost their appeals. And in the land of the free, they were jailed for their beliefs.
Wow. We had Pete Seeger on this program 2 days ago, and when he was dragged before the House Un-American Activities Committee, they asked him if he was going to invoke the Fifth Amendment, and he said, no, I'm invoking the First Amendment. I have a right to associate with anybody I damn well please.
Well, that
and
is
say anything I want.
That is a cherished American right, and unfortunately what happened in the first wave of the blacklisting, people pragmatically saw that the First Amendment would not defend you, and they did go to jail, and they did have to pay fines.
Yeah, well, Pete Seeger was blacklisted, too.
That's right. In 1951, the tactic on the left changed to pleading the Fifth Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Because in America, where we always love to talk about what a free country it is, you could say whatever you want, in America, the First Amendment didn't defend you.
Yeah, this is a tragic thing. And the... Tell us about Joe McCarthy's role in this. People say Joe McCarthy, and everybody thinks that they know what we're talking about. You know, Ann Coulter has written an entire book defending him, saying that he was a great American hero.
Birds of a feather.
Yeah, my recollection is that he was a rather morbid alcoholic who opportunist who lied about his war record in order to get elected.
Well, you know that Ann Coulter actually makes one point that is almost factually correct, although it's hard to believe. And that is that she points out, and this is accurate, that the House Un-American Activities Committee was part of the House of Representatives. Senator McCarthy was part of the U.S. Senate. Now, on the other hand, people like Coulter say that he did not have hearings with Hollywood talents and so on. But in fact, he had a few, and they included Howard Fast, who wrote the novel that Spartacus was based on. And of course, that movie Spartacus is very important in breaking the blacklist in 1960 because it was written by one of the blacklisted Hollywood Ten, and Kirk Douglas let Dalton Trumbo get a screen credit. But Joe McCarthy did call up a few of the talents, but his main focus was on the State Department and the U.S. Army. And he was a complete...
The McCarthy Army hearings was
that's
was
right.
Famous, yeah.
He was a complete opportunist. His assistant, we should not forget that Bobby Kennedy was part of that committee.
He was a lawyer for the committee. Yeah.
Yes, that's right. And but much more active was Roy Cohn, who is the archetype of the self-hating gay who persecutes others for being homosexuals while he himself privately practices the lifestyle he publicly condemns. Joe McCarthy was toppled by the man that I was named after, Edward R. Murrow.
And yeah, in fact, I've seen this note to your father from Edward R. Murrow, saying, thank you. He said, I have a child prodigy named in my honor.
Of course, Murrow was half right. I was a child, and my father belonged to a blacklisted group, and he refused to take a loyalty oath. He was a New York City school teacher, and he really admired when on CBS TV, on Mr. Murrow's show, how he exposed McCarthy, and he did it in such a clever way by giving him the proverbial enough rope to hang himself. And then, of course, McCarthy ended up making that really wonderful, beautiful speech at the end of his program attacking McCarthy, where my namesake says that we are not descended from fearful men. And he sort of rallied the American people to stand up when he said, we will not be driven by fear. If we dig deep in our history and our doctrine and remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who fear to write, to speak, to associate, and to defend causes that were, for the moment, unpopular. And McCarthy was finished soon afterwards.
Yeah, yeah. And in the minds and eyes of the American people. And a fine thing it was. This is the 60th anniversary. Ed, we just have, 5-10 seconds. We need to be eternally vigilant, I guess, would be the main message to carry
out of
this.
That's right. And tomorrow night, Friday night in Los Angeles at the Skirball Cultural Center, will be a reenactment of what happened 60 years ago, October 26, 1947, when Bogey Bacall, Judy Garland did the Hollywood Fights Back broadcast against the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Right, and this is going to be done with actors like Ed Asner and Children of the Hollywood Ten, the Skirball Cultural Center tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in L.A. Ed Rampell, disinfo.com for more information, as well as many other sites. Ed, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Great talking to you.
And for your great book, Progressive Hollywood, A People's Film History of the United States.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
Love that.
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Christy Harvey is with us with the Center for American Progress. She's the Director of Strategic Communications for the Center of American Progress and also does the daily news prep site, miccheckradio.org. And Christy, welcome.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. Great
good,
to have you
good.
Here with us. You are our absolute expert on what's flying under the radar. By the way, did you have you had an opportunity to, we talked last week about tracking down a map of the Minneapolis airport.
I haven't yet, but I have started to look around a little bit. I did see, however, that Larry Craig is no longer flying through that airport. I guess too many bad memories, or good ones. He's now going through the Denver airport on his way home.
In fact, after I Googled it this morning, I thought, okay, I'm sitting here at KPOJ, which is where we do the show from, you know, a Clear Channel station in Portland, Oregon, and using one of the Clear Channel computers. Now it's in the cache that this morning I Googled gay sex Denver airport bathrooms. And, you know, wondering if, because apparently this bathroom that he got busted in Minneapolis was like, you know, there were websites devoted to it. It was
a
famous bathroom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And think about it this way. Now when, you know, the government goes after you and is tracking where you've been on the Internet, they've got something interesting to read.
Yeah, apparently. And from time to time, I do fly through Denver. That's going to, well, in any case, tonight I'm flying to Seattle, so not quite the same. And I haven't Googled that airport.
Gotcha.
What do you see flying under the radar here? What are the stories that you're noticing over at the Center for American Progress that we really need to be knowing about?
I just saw one that I thought was very, very interesting pop up, and these are about some leaked emails that ABC News, the blotter blog, got their hands on. And these are emails that show that according to an internal State Department email traffic, the State Department knew about what was going on and the problems with Blackwater and the killing of innocent civilians in Iraq and the bad feelings it was causing more than 2 years ago. Now, keep
two
in mind,
years ago.
2 years ago. Yet it took the public killings, obviously, that happened in September to get the State Department to, A, admit there was a problem, and, B, to get Condi Rice to admit that she was going to take action and have a review. So while we are all just finding out about this basically now, the State Department knew about this 2 years ago and sat on it and did nothing and actually acted to try and cover things up.
This is crony capitalism on steroids.
It really, really is, Tom. And, for example, there's one set of emails that I thought was fascinating. I love sort of the inner workings of how the devious minds work. And they have the actual emails online at ABC News. And it shows the back and forth between some State Department officials about how to stonewall an L.A. Times reporter who had got wind of a story about some Blackwater killings of innocent civilians in Baghdad right near the ABC News headquarters. And
wait a minute. The State Department was conspiring with a private corporation to conceal the crimes of a private corporation?
They were sort of conspiring within themselves on how to spin the L.A. Times so they didn't get wind of the story and said, you know, whenever you're asked about what we're doing to investigate on in this, say that you have to refer it to the lawyers and say that and make sure everything is off the record, make sure that they don't get wind of any of this. And then there's a separate set of emails, which I thought were equally insane, where some officials in Baghdad said, look, Blackwater just killed a bunch of people. The civilians and the families are angry, and it's really difficult for us to go in there, quote, with nothing more to offer than apologies and vague promises. And the State Department said, well, for us to do anything or for us to criminally prosecute these people isn't feasible, and the only course of action we have is to fire them. That's really it.
Amazing.
Speaking of...
Yeah, it is. It's tragic. Speaking of crony capitalism, the body armor business has been doing very well since we invaded Iraq.
Yes, it has.
And one of their CEOs has now in a little hot water?
Huge hot water. And this one really just makes my blood boil. So we were getting most of our body armor from a little company called DHB Industries. And in a completely separate story, though very connected, DHB is under investigation right now by the Justice Department because it turned out they were giving our troops over there faulty armor. They were filling the armor with something called Xylor, which made the armor have, quote, critical life-threatening flaws. So at the same time this is going on and they're, you know, charging the U.S. military gazillions of dollars to sell them faulty armor that puts our troops' lives at risk. At the same time, the CEO of the company is basically cheating the company out of every dollar it earns so he can have this crazy lifestyle. For example, he threw in 2005 a $10 million bat mitzvah for his daughter with Aerosmith and Tom Petty. He used
$10 million bat mitzvah?
$10 million bat mitzvah. I know, right?
Whoa.
My 21st birthday party, I think, was $75. He also spent company money that was, you know, coming straight from the U.S. government, spent it on a facelift for his wife, spent it on a private jet, a Bentley Flying Spur. And so now he got arrested, and he's facing tons of charges for embezzlement, insider training, and securities fraud.
Yeah. And I wonder if the Democrats had not taken control of Congress, if he ever would have been arrested. You know,
makes you wonder.
If the federal U.S. attorneys who were doing their jobs, prosecuting Democrats, not Republicans. Anyhow, Christy Harvey, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Yeah, 34 minutes past the hour. Hey, just a special alert to our listeners in New York, especially those who might be thinking about going out to Dutchess County this weekend, or Monday, actually, I guess is the day. Think Progress reporting that the Poughkeepsie Journal is reporting that Vice President Dick Cheney is coming to Dutchess County again to go hunting. So maybe look out. Ah, it's Cheney, and he's got a gun in one hand and a gin and tonic in the other. It's good. So anyhow, keep your eyes open. Mark Carlin is with us with BuzzFlash.com, the editor and founder of BuzzFlash.com, and Faz Shakir. He is the research director for the Center for American Progress and serves as editor of ThinkProgress.org and the Progress Report. Gentlemen, both welcome for our Best of the Rest of the News segment.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you both with us. Faz, first of all, congratulations. I was hoping that I would be named one of the 10 most dangerous organizations in the world, or at least Air America might, but you guys made the list.
I know. Our little six-person team here was, I guess, sufficient to qualify for organizational purposes, and we are number 10, but we're shooting for higher, Tom, and we're going for number one. We got to beat universities and colleges, who is ranked number two, and Media Matters, who is ranked number one, so that we got our eye on them.
Yeah, there you go. It's a good thing. Faz, what over at thinkprogress.org and at the Center for American Progress, what do you see as the top two stories of the day? What are the things that, or of the week, let's say, because this is kind of a weekly roundup piece?
Mm-hmm. The ones, I feel like the ones this week were the wildfires in general, and I think it didn't materialize as a political issue as much as I thought it would have, particularly with respect to California National Guard issues there and the resources that might be in Iraq. I thought it would
in
be
part
more,
that might have been because Arnold Schwarzenegger came out yesterday and said this has got nothing to do with Iraq, even as his lieutenant governor is saying this is all about what's going on in Iraq.
That's right, and Barbara Boxer as well said that. So and yeah. He had conflicting messages, but clearly I think Schwarzenegger was trying to downplay that and try to come to President Bush's aid. I think next week you're going to see perhaps second round of the S-chip fight. So Michelle Malkin and company, the right wing, are going to be gearing up to smear some other folks, and I think the House Democrats are looking to capitalize on the momentum that they had on this issue before, and I think it replaces Iraq right now because Iraq is kind of receding as a political issue, unfortunately. I wish it were not. I wish that our candidates in the House and the Senate were striking a clear contrast on that one, but they seem to be muddying the picture and kind of not talking about that issue very much.
Right.
So.
And just speaking of S-chip, there's a new spot that's coming out, and I think, is it over in Think Progress? I'm not sure where I saw this morning,
yeah.
But let me. Okay, it's at thinkprogress.org.
It's Campaign for America's Future released this new video, I believe is the one you're talking about.
Yeah, and here it is.
Hey, Congress, remember me? I'm one of those children, the kind you say you won't leave behind. We've been there for you here, here, here,
and these are all photos
here,
of, like, the president with kids and Republican members of Congress
and kids.
We've
been there for this guy. Now he's left us behind without health care. He vetoed health care for kids that a big majority in Congress voted for. I know you like us, kids, but if you want to keep us hanging out with you for the cameras, You need to protect us, not the president. No health care for us, no photo ops for you. Believe me, we've got better things to do.
This is absolutely great. It's an absolutely brilliant piece. And I agree with you, Faz. That's going to be a big deal next week. Mark Carlin over at BuzzFlash.com, one of the great progressive news sites. Mark, what do you see as the big stories of the week?
Well, we have a personal news story. We were one of the few websites, if not the only one, to be granted an interview with Ellie Plame Wilson this week on Tuesday, and it's posted today as our headline story. And I just don't think we can afford to forget, as Bob Novak is on Fox News this week with Alvin North claiming no crime was committed. Everyone knew what she was doing. That what the White House did was a detriment to our national security, made us more vulnerable to weapons of mass destruction, and undercut the national security of the United States by outing a CIA covert operative who specialized in tracking the illicit sale and possession of weapons of mass destruction. In our interview with Valerie, one of the things I mentioned to her was that to the person on the street, this sounds so astounding that a president and a White House and a vice president would put the country at risk simply out of vengeance, that they simply, a lot of people say, well, Valerie Plame and Joe Wilson, you can't believe them because what they're asserting is so preposterous. But no president of the United States would undercut the national security. But that's exactly
treason.
What they did.
No president would do that.
That's exactly what they did. And sometimes something that is so unfathomable is simply hard for people to comprehend. So that interview is very important to us. And one other thing it does reiterate is that the initial legal action was taken at the request. We have to remind people of the CIA. This had nothing to do with Valerie Plame requesting a legal action. The CIA requested the Justice Department to look into whether the act that was passed many years ago to protect the identity of CIA agents had been violated. And that is what put this all into play that led to the prosecution of Scooter Libby and so forth. And we forget that. And we forget that we still have a White House in place that chose to sacrifice our national security in order to seek vengeance on someone that had embarrassed them, caught them in a lie. Another story that I think is extremely important and you've covered, but we just can't forget, we're projecting now, we're seeing reports that the combined wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, with enough wiggle room to bomb Iran, are going to cost over $2 trillion at a time when today, as we know, the House is considering and will probably pass another slightly revised S-CHIP bill, which the White House says it will veto because it costs too much. And the risk versus benefit of all this is just astonishing. $2 trillion for a war that, by all accounts, has failed, and yet the president says we can't afford to provide health insurance for the children of America who need it. The third story I would quickly say, that we just found interesting, and it's a little nugget out there. It won't make a major splash, but of all people, a military commentator, former colonel for Fox, claims in a piece on Fox News on the Internet that the Bush administration had Osama in their sights, could have easily taken him out in August of this year, but chose not to do it. And he says this is unfathomable, it's a criminal act, and he simply can't comprehend why. And if he is accurate, then we are left asking the question, indeed, why did the Bush administration not take out Osama bin Laden?
Why did they not take him out of Tora Bora, for that matter? I mean, because he's politically useful. It's always nice to have a boogeyman out there intact. The most boring fictional story in the world would be Superman if there wasn't for Kryptonite and Lex Luthor. I'm serious. You can't have a superhero without a supervillain.
And that, of course, then becomes further justification for the war in Iraq. I might add one other minor point, and I'm you know, dangerously getting into Fox propaganda news territory here, but you've probably discussed this. It was on Think Progress that Fox News was claiming the other day that these wildfires were probably or possibly set by Al-Qaeda terrorists, which leads us to believe, as you know, I think I heard on Progressive Radio, I can't recall if it was your show, someone called in and said, well, if Bush has always been saying we have to fight them over here so we don't have to, we have to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them over here, well, if the, if they are setting these fires in
California, it's time to bring our soldiers back home to fight
them.
Let's
bring the soldiers back home now.
Right. Yeah, good. Yeah, that was our show, that brilliant caller. Thank you, Mark. Faz Shakir over at the Center for American Progress, thinkprogress.org. What do you see on the horizon? What are the small stories that either should have more light shined on them or you expect are going to become the big stories?
Well, I don't know if it's a, this is certainly not a small story, but I think it's going to continue to get bigger, and this is just generally the Iran issue. It seems like every week, it's surprising to me, but every week we take another significant notch or step forward towards bombing Iran. And, you know, we've always, those of us who have been warning of this kind of thing have been called, you know, crazy lunatics who are, you know, living in a conspiracy land. But yet you look at the evidence and you look at the direction the debate's going. You saw the administration this morning announcing new sanctions, which apparently seems to suggest that Condi Rice is winning in the battle against Dick Cheney, but clearly sets the stage for Condi Rice losing to Dick Cheney in the next year or so.
Right.
And this week, I think the significant report that we saw is that in President Bush's budget request, he's requesting some funding for B-2 stealth bombers to launch what would be the types of bombing ordinances that you would need to go after Iran's nuclear program, and he's requesting
$88 million buried in this multi-billion-dollar, $189 billion appropriations bill. Just, you know, one little line item in there. We just need to modify these stealth bombers so we can drop bombs on Iran.
That's right.
Yeah.
And of course, you look at Rudy Giuliani, who this morning you saw in the New York Times getting advised by, you know, the neocons and Mitt Romney, everybody who's trying is suggesting they're going to go be the ones to do this. And so
Rudy says he doesn't have a problem with a little aerial bombardment.
That's right.
Amazing. Faz Shakir, thinkprogress.org. Mark Carlin, buzzflash.com. Gentlemen, both, thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you both. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all. Go ask Alice. She's 10 feet tall. And if you go chasing rabbits and you know you're going to fall, tell them a hookah smoking caterpillar.
Speaking of worlds where hookah-smoking caterpillars are hanging out, I just got an email from a listener saying that in the Minneapolis airport, there is a giant Snoopy, as in the Peanuts character, a giant Snoopy outside the men's room where Larry Craig was busted, which apparently is in the center of the airport where all of the terminals all come together, right over by the TSA place. But who knows? I mean, maybe, maybe not. But boy, you can't make this stuff. I mean, you couldn't write this stuff. You can't make this stuff up. By the way, tomorrow night, Elliott Bay Bookstore, I'll be signing books and talking about my new book, Cracking the Code, which is now out. And on Saturday, I'll be at Sonoma State University receiving the first place in the Project Censored Award and giving a speech on November 3rd. We'll be in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'll be the keynote speaker at the Holistic Management International Conference and doing a book signing at Hastings Books and Music at 5 p.m. in Albuquerque. Victoria Jones on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, their website. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom. Good day to you. It's pouring with rain here, and we're not happy about it, but what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, it happens here too, like for about 5 months.
Exactly. I didn't expect much sympathy from you, really.
No.
Really didn't. Just thought I'd have a little wine.
Well,
the president, not only on his way to California, has arrived, and we don't have very much from him yet, but he has already said that history will make the comparisons between this particular disaster and Katrina. Of course, some comparisons already are being made in terms of the comparison, which is that one was black and poor, the other is white and rich. So, but nevertheless, that is what he said so far. But the big story really coming out of Washington is on the S-CHIP vote happening today, where Republicans are complaining that Democrats are holding it today because many Republicans are going to be in California for President Bush's tour, and so they won't be present for the vote.
Mm-hmm.
They're not happy about this.
Wait a minute. Let me understand that. The Republicans are not going to be present for the S-CHIP vote, and they're not happy about that?
That's correct.
The Republicans are not happy that they're. It seems to me like they'd be.
They'd like to be there to vote.
That they're not going to be there.
Yes. Well,
oh,
I
see.
Republicans want to be there to vote.
Oh.
Now.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought that what you were suggesting was that they didn't. I was figuring that they really don't want to vote no again, and that I thought you were being ironic. They seriously want to vote no on this thing. They want to plant this flag on. You know, we're gonna kick kids upside the head.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what they intend to do, yes.
That's astounding, because I would have thought by now that they would have done the political math and said, this is a loser, this is crazy. It'll be a good thing if we're out of town and don't have to vote on this and go on the record.
No, they genuinely seem to believe that the right thing to do is to vote on this, be on the record as being against children's health insurance. The way that it is written, they think that they can make the argument to their constituencies that they're doing the right thing. It can be a very difficult argument to make. But the Democrats have said, no, we intend to go forward with this. And,
yeah,
of course, they intend to go forward with it again and again and again. They say that they've made the changes that were needed, the changes that the Republicans complained about, but the Republicans are saying, look, the changes you've made are merely cosmetic. They don't address our issues.
Right. What else is going on in Washington, D.C.?
Well, we imposed sanctions against Iran today. We targeted two groups, and a whole load of banks and people that we accuse of backing nuclear proliferation and terror-related activities. Basically, this is yet another way of cracking down on Iran. This is interesting in light of more and more articles that have been coming out about how Iran has been making moves towards us, not quite as recently, but in the last several years leading up to and after 2001, particularly towards really being conciliatory. But we're very much cracking down. They're talking about the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the Quds Force, and these banks, and mostly because of their support for proliferation,
We're trying to provoke them is the bottom line. Has anybody pointed out that Dick Cheney, when he was CEO of Halliburton, had Halliburton doing business with the government of Iran?
So the big story about Dick Cheney today, I have to tell you, is how he fell asleep during a briefing on the wildfires yesterday.
Yeah, yeah. And that he's going hunting on Monday.
And
Doc, look out! There he goes. Sorry. My new Dick Cheney sound effect.
Do it again.
All right, here you go. It's a pretty good one.
It's a good one.
Yeah, my brother can pull them off like that when we're on the range. So what do you see coming down the road here, Victoria, in Washington, D.C.? It does seem that the fires, the S-CHIP, and Iran are the issues that are dominating everything. Iraq seems to be receding into the background.
Well, it's receding into the background because we're absolutely constitutionally incapable of concentrating on more than two stories at the same time. So they have to make decisions in the networks about which stories get covered and which don't. So they've decided that Iraq is not important enough. And this despite the fact that the president asked on Monday for $46 billion more to cover Iraq. So even with that, we're still not going to cover Iraq. So the money will literally go down the drain and we'll never see it again.
We talked with Congressman Errol Blumenauer earlier. He said he will not vote for this. He will not vote for any appropriations bill for Iraq that does not include a withdrawal. Do you think that more and more members of Congress are going to start taking that hard position?
I think a few of them are. I think they're going to be few and far between who will take the kind of position that he's taking, to be honest with you. They still are terrified of being seen as being against the troops.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, you know, I think the very best slogan, the very best bumper sticker is support our troops, bring them home. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Victoria, thanks so much for sharing with us
this
afternoon. Have a great weekend. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be live from Talk 1090 in Seattle. It'll be Anything Goes Friday. Senator Bernie Sanders, our first hour, Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon. Right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow from Seattle.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.